This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Mumia Abu-Jamal talks about betrayal and fear in the U.S. presidential election. An advocate of torture may be in line to head up Donald Trump's CIA. And is this finally the end of corporate Democrats like the Clintons and Barack Obama?
But first, Ajamu Baraka, a founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network and an editor and columnist with Black Agenda Report, was also the Green Party's vice presidential candidate. We asked Baraka how he felt about the Greens' performance.
Well, I was somewhat surprised in the sense that I fully expected that we were going to get at least 5% of the vote. And that was based on the kind of momentum that we felt in the last few weeks of October, watching the analytics that we were able to do. We didn't have much because we didn't have much money for our campaign, but we felt like there were a number of people who, despite the fear-mongering and the shaming and the bullying, that there were a number of people who were prepared to express their opposition to the Democratic Party and commit themselves to a new kind of politics that was for something as opposed to just being against something. So we thought that we were going to probably hit that 5%. But I suspect that when push came to shove, in particular in those so-called swing states, as those states tightened back up, that people held their nose and voted for the lesser of two evils. So I was a bit surprised by that, but still feel good about the fact that we engaged the people. We raised the issues. We came under withering attack from the corporate media and the Clinton machine, and we withstood it. So we have work to do now. And it's interesting that there was a piece just came out in the Washington Post that suggested that a good portion of the folks who are engaged in these demonstrations across the country are, in fact, folks who supported the Stein-Baraka ticket, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, what do you think you learned about the Green Party specifically and the struggle to create a broad social democratic kind of opposition to the corporate parties? What did you learn in the course of this campaign?
Well, I learned that that process of building an oppositional apparatus is more than a notion, that you have to have a plan that is years in the making, and you have to have clear and deep ties to the social movements with a very clear strategy. You know, if folks are going to engage in the electoral process on the national level, because it takes such an incredible amount of money and time, it has to be guided by a clear strategy. And that strategy may not include a 50-state run. It may be more narrowly focused. So you have to develop a clear strategy. You have to have a strategy that is clear about one of the other intents, which has to be that if you run a national campaign, that campaign has to be a campaign that the main objective of the campaign is to strengthen your state and local apparatuses. And you have to have a platform in which there are clear reforms, but you have to be honest enough to engage the people, let them know that you're not going to be pushing the notion that these reforms are supposed to be reflective of a revolutionary solution, that in fact they are transitional demands that are meant to galvanize people, win concessions from the state as you gain power, but that you keep people focused on the fact that the real objective is to transform this system, to take power from the capitalist state. So I think clear messaging and effective apparatus, I mean, it was just affirmed to me from this experience how important those elements are.
Yes, some folks think that the function of a left electoral party is to be the voice of the social movement.
Well, it can be. It can be. But that relationship between the electoral arm, if you will, and the social movements has to be real and deep, again, and guided by a very clear strategy. We're not there yet. We are getting there. There was some significant progress, but there's still work to do internally within that Green Party. I think we have to continue to struggle for a clear working class perspective, a clear anti-capitalist position. There are some great activists in that Green Party and some people with some very clear politics, you know, but it's still a relatively broad party to a certain extent. And there has to be some internal struggle around what the current situation demands in terms of a clear political line and how that party is going to be developed. Now, this notion that I'm hearing people talk about that they want to build a brand new party. I heard our dear sister the other night, Angela Davis, talk about the need for building a new party. But, you know, I really don't take those statements seriously because there's a logic out there among these progressives that held their nose and voted for Hillary Clinton. And that is that they weren't prepared to support a Green Party ticket that had their principles in politics because we weren't able to win. Well, if that's the logic, then if we build a new party outside of the Green Party, that party's not going to be in a position to automatically win. So they're not really serious about building a third party alternative. And they don't really understand how incredibly difficult that is. I had a chance to see how this party apparatus operates and the kind of time and effort it took even to get on the ballot. So this third party challenge within bourgeois politics is more than a notion, and people need to understand that if they're going to engage in this electoral process.
The one thing that the Green Party has proven is that it has the expertise to get on all of these battles, something that other left organizers have not done.
Exactly, and there's something to say about that kind of experience. You know, you build experience, I mean, through your practice, of course, and the Green Party now has a degree of experience running these national campaigns that's starting to crystallize in a core group of folks with the kind of skills that are necessary in order to manage and advance a campaign at the national level. But that's a consequence of a couple of decades now of serious work. So again, this is not something that you just think about at night and decide you're going to get up the next morning and start trying to build. And that's why I think that if people understood that this apparatus, this Green Party apparatus, is in place and is open for new participation, then for those folks who are pretending like they see a need for a different party, they might want to take a second look at going into a structure that already exists and helping to strengthen and expand that structure. Again, if you think that electoral politics is a viable instrument to be used as part of a broader strategy.
Donald Trump said, well, he said many things, but he sometimes said things that led folks to believe that he was against regime change and wanted to reset relationships between the U.S. and Russia and China. But where's he going to find the personnel among the folks around him to make that kind of reset?
It's clear from what we are seeing over the last few days that Donald Trump, with his populist agenda, is starting to realign himself with the Republican traditionalists. I mean, those individuals who have some experience in government, who have a particular worldview, he is, as you say, because he doesn't have the personnel outside of the Republican circles to really be a real radical, he is forced to begin to depend on or go back to those traditional elements within the Republican Party. So I think Chris Hedges said this, and I think some other folks too, perhaps yourself included, that once his supporters understand that this system is rigged, that they're not rigged in the sense that he talked about, but that the system is rigged in the sense that Donald Trump also represents interests that are counter to theirs, that he's part of the 1%, and that the 1% is committed to upholding this corrupt and backward capitalist system, that when it becomes clear that he doesn't have the ability to deliver on the promises for, quote unquote, making America great and revitalizing the rural parts of this country and creating new jobs in urban areas, and that they have been duped, I think then we're going to see some real serious consequences once that becomes clear. And consequences that, in fact, potentially could be progressive, except that, you know, we know that part of the way in which Donald Trump won was to build, in effect, a white united front, a cross-class white united front. And these folks are serious enough in terms of their commitment to white nationalism And we know that there is a segment of that population that's very anti-government. And so there is a clear possibility that many of those elements can, in fact, find themselves enhanced by the disaffected Trump supporters who then now prepared to go all the way in terms of really targeting the state from the right.
Well, black Democrats have spoken the language of United Front as well, united with Hillary and other corporate Democrats.
Exactly. And that sort of class subordination will continue. We see that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, the liberal darlings, have already signaled to Donald Trump that they're prepared to play ball. We see all of the liberal elements, including the labor leaders, who have signaled that they're not going to be in opposition, that they, in fact, believe that they can find a way, as they say, to work with Donald Trump. And we see that the progressives that held their nose and voted and ran to the protective arms of the Democratic Party will continue to play the role of subordinates who only mobilize when needed. And this fake sort of progressive response, advancing people like Keith Ellison, who is supposed to be their progressive savior, to me is not a serious example of a real challenge internally to the Democratic Party. So it's going to be politics as usual. The kind of disarray and the kind of fight that people predicted would occur within the Democratic Party as a consequence of the loss by Hillary Clinton, I don't see that really happening, because those so-called progressive forces inside the Democratic Party are not really prepared to disrupt. They're not really prepared to engage in a real struggle for power within that party, in my opinion.
Yes, Keith Ellison was for the assault against Libya and for the proxy war against Syria.
Exactly. And this is an example of their best in terms of progressive politics. I mean, it really shows how far to the right the Democratic Party is and how far to the right these so-called progressives are. That Keith Ellison 30 years ago would have been on the far right of the CBC, the Congressional Black Caucus. But, you know, he's a progressive now. So this is the kind of politics and the kind of political atmosphere that we have right now. And I'm so happy to see that there is some opposition. Wish that we would have had opposition that went beyond just the sort of personalized concern about this individual Trump representing a certain kind of politics, that the opposition would have been based on principles and politics. And we would have seen that opposition express itself under our first black president. But we didn't have that much, and now I see at least some people have gone into an oppositional mode. I'm hoping, though, that this mobilization, that this translates into more sustained organizing based on some kind of common understanding of a national program to unite progressive and radical forces here in this country. But I know that's going to take some time to forge with the kind of disorganization and ideological confusion we have on the left this moment.
Do you expect the Green Party to be playing a big role in forging that kind of program?
We are in conversations. We think that we have the ability to facilitate that process, and we're going to attempt, I think, to do that. I mean, because we promised we would. Because my consistent message during the campaign was that this wasn't about November the 8th. This was about what happens after the 8th. It was about building an apparatus that will be linked up with the social movements and to engage and struggle, because my position was then and today is that it wouldn't have mattered who won. For those of us who are members of the oppressed communities, we were going to have to struggle no matter what. The only question was, where would our allies be? Well, now we see that now with this anxiety and fear generated by the capturing of the executive by Trump and Trumpism, now people are beginning to wake up and are prepared to engage in some oppositional politics, and we will fulfill our responsibility in trying to help facilitate that. But it's going to take a united front effort. It's going to take a real commitment on the part of people to learn how to work around their differences. You know, there's one thing that should be obvious when we watch how the bourgeois elements operate. They could be in intense struggle, but at certain points, they will figure out a way in which they can coalesce and work together. On the left, there is this immaturity, this search for purity, in which, you know, if there's any kind of difference on any level, then you find a way in which you can't work with folks. And that has been a real issue in terms of trying to forge some principled unity among the broad array of left forces here in this country. We've got to grow up politically because the stakes are really too high at this point to do otherwise.
That was former Green Party vice presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka.
Historian and author Paul Street is a keen observer of the crisis in the U.S. two-party electoral system. He says if the Democrats offer nothing to working-class voters, then they shouldn't expect to win states like Michigan and Ohio.
The main thing I've been saying lately, and I get some resonance from it, and I see people, I see students listening to it and seeing that there's some wisdom in it, is that there's this definition, this reigning dominant definition of citizenship and participation, being that you go in a voting booth for 5 minutes once every 4 years. What is that, 14, 60 days, something like that. And for 5 minutes, you touch a screen, you poke a hole, or you make a mark on a ballot, and then you go home and you let other people run the world. I always say let other rich, powerful people run the world into the ground. And that politics is over. It's absolutely dead now. We needed to understand that it needed to be dead if Hillary Clinton was coming in. I fully expected her to squeak through, to have enough of a margin in the contested states to get past the shenanigans which take place with voting machines and software and voter suppression in key contested states every 4 years. They try to steal the election every 4 years. I expected her to just get, like Obama did, to get over enough to squeak through, and then that main task for the movement politics that matters so much more than the electoral politics to be focused in no small measure on rebuilding an anti-war movement to stop what appeared to be Hillary Clinton's drive for World War III with Russia, with her no-fly zone over Syria and all that. Much to my surprise, no, not completely to my surprise, but somewhat to my surprise, somewhat to my chagrin, she was not able to pull that off. She could not resurrect the Obama coalition, or who knows, maybe she did, and the Republican control of the voting machinery in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, and North Carolina made sure that it didn't register, or some combination of both. She wasn't able to do it, and I think the threat of World War III has receded significantly. I don't know if I'll think that about Trump in 2 years and Mike Pence being in charge of policy and saying that his role model is Dick Cheney. I mean, it's entirely possible they'll put people around him that'll resurrect this conflict with Russia. That conflict seems to have faded, and the more immediate existential dangers seem to be police statist assault on undocumented Latino immigrants, a registry for Muslims, a potential designation of Black Lives Matter and civil rights activists as quasi-terrorists, if not literal terrorists. I can see them deputizing the National Guard and sending out federal marshals and replacing rubber bullets with live ammunition against the pipeline fighters on Standing Rock in North Dakota. So that kind of stuff, racist police statism. I can see us revisiting the heroic struggles against the Fugitive Slave Act as we struggle to protect undocumented people, that state gendarmes may be affiliated with and assisted by white nationalist Americana vigilantes trying to round up people for deportation. I can see that. And the other great existential threat now, it seems to me, is runaway climate change, because Trump has pledged to thoroughly deregulate energy, and he's going to open up Alaska and other places for full oil drilling and try and deregulate and try and get coal back on, all kinds of just horrific things that really could put us past the last tipping point environment.
In terms of domestic fears, if a President Trump decides to turn to domestic repression, he certainly has many tools at hand that were bequeathed to him by Barack Obama, who increased dramatically the militarization of local police and, of course, set a new bar for deportations of folk, and who pushed through Congress a bill that allows for the detention without trial or charge of U.S. citizens.
And you know, when you're saying that, I'm just connecting with this kind of sense that I know that you share with me, which is all you folks that are upset about this, where were you? Why, you're mad now? You're mad because Republicans are going to do this stuff. Where were you when a Democrat is doing that kind of stuff. It's a very legitimate anger on our place. I'm trying to find a happy medium, you know, the right chords, you know, to make this point, to suggest to people that they need to revisit the Obama administration. Really, they need to revisit the history of the neoliberal Democratic Party going back for decades. And to say that without alienating to the point that they don't want to participate alongside leftists, you know, in demonstrations, I think that's very tricky. But, you know, I mean, you're absolutely right. And let's just take the immigrant issue. Barack Obama became the deporter-in-chief, and he did it very quickly in a quite sinister fashion. And was it 2.5 million that he deported from this country? What he did is just changed the style of it. He did it in a stealthier fashion. He dropped the politically provocative, outlandish, quasi-fascist military raids that Bush 43 was doing in places like Marshalltown, Iowa. And they just got their operatives in there, Obama that is, and got into the offices of the factories where Latinos were working and got a hold of the Social Security numbers and much more stealthily and in a much more sophisticated kind of way deported people like that. I mean, so I think you're absolutely right. We've got a whole record of insidious FBI, Homeland Security, infiltration, surveillance, arrest, and repression in alliance with Democratic Party-controlled city governments from coast to coast. Repression of Occupy in 2011, the incredible outpouring of militarized policing against the great marches against North Atlantic Treaty Organization in Chicago in May of 2012, and ditto for Black Lives Matter, you know, urban city governments, oftentimes with black elected officials in high positions, fully involved in that kind of police state repression. So I agree with you on that 100%.
The Syrians and the Russians and lots of folks in the world seem to be breathing at least a tentative sigh of relief that Hillary Clinton and her saber-rattling and no-fly zone proposing self will not be in the White House. But it's difficult to imagine what kind of team a President Trump, who, if he really wants to reset relations between the U.S. and Russia, for example, it's difficult to see where he's going to create a team from.
I don't know how Trump does that. He was opposed by the majority of the bipartisan Imperial Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Policy establishment, you know, from people like Elliot Cohen on the right to, you know, more sort of Center for American Progress type of neoliberal Democrats on the so-called left. You know, I mean, this is sort of across the board. Who staffs these positions, who makes up the grand strategy-making offices, the national security advisors, the secretary of state, the sort of people in and around a president. I don't know how he's going to have a functional American imperial foreign policy elite when he's excluded, if he's going to exclude such a large percentage who makes up the foreign policy ruling class in this country. I tend to think at the end of the day, he won't be able to do it, and they won't allow him to do it. I just can't believe that this administration is going to be off the charts completely from every presidential administration of my lifetime, which is always predominantly staffed by Council of Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, Bilderberg, a group, Atlantic Alliance, pro-NATO types of people. I would not be surprised to see this horrible transition process just degenerate further and ultimately him having to sort of surrender. And while we may be breathing easy on Russia, on the prospects of World War III right now, 2 years down the road, I think it's entirely possible that he will feel compelled again to be saber-rattling and to be engaged in all kinds of provocation with regard to both China and Russia. I mean, there's been a sea change sort of in the mindset of the imperial establishment, and I really doubt that Trump has the kind of power to reverse that and then to make them seem quote-unquote isolationist. His vice president is slated to be the most powerful vice president probably since Dick Cheney, who strikes me as kind of a white nationalist fascist in his own right. Pence has proclaimed that his role model is Dick Cheney, and Dick Cheney was a very aggressive imperial expansionist. And, you know, by the way, I hope some of your listeners heard Trump some people on the left have almost been giving Trump credit for supposedly being against the Iraq war. Well, A, he really wasn't, but at least once during the debates, I heard, it was just hilarious. I heard him say that one of the ways that Bush and the rest of the policymakers bungled the Iraq war is, quote, they didn't even get the oil. They didn't even get the oil. That's his definition, right, of a screwed up foreign policy. They invaded the country and they didn't even grab control of all its oil. It's kind of like what's wrong with Hillary's and Obama's Libya policy was that some CIA agents got killed, right? Not the hundreds of thousands of people, including the many Africans that were slaughtered in the wake of the Islamist uprising in Libya, right? But there's four CIA agents. So, you know, we got to get the oil and we got to protect our CIA agents.
In addition to the national security establishment in Hillary's big tent, there was also almost the totality of the corporate media. It'll be interesting to see how they make a transition. Since the corporate media essentially serve power, how are they going to go back to serving power, in the White House at least?
I'm not all that surprised by the working class, middle class white rage that's out there. I'm not particularly surprised that Trump was able to pull it off vis-a-vis the horrible, demobilizing, depressing, corrupt, centrist Hillary. I think Trump was probably able to pull it off only with some assistance from voter suppression and from just ridiculous shenanigans in terms of how we count our votes and tabulate our votes in this country. The most astonishing thing is that he was able to defeat the fairly united opposition of most of Wall Street and the imperial establishment. And, yeah, the corporate media, which I think sort of looking back ruefully now in retrospect is wishing it hadn't given so much phenomenal media attention to Trump. I mean, literally to the point of just about any facial expression or tweet or just, you know, preposterous, ridiculous thing he said or did was 10 o'clock news. You know, it was all over CNN. I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders, I had a lot of issues with Bernie Sanders, but A, I think he would have defeated Trump in all likelihood, and B, he had some rather remarkable rallies around the issue of economic equality, and the media could hardly bother to acknowledge. I mean, one ridiculous Trump tweet trumped 15,000 people rallying against economic inequality at a Sanders rally. So the corporate media, I think, can be sort of expected to whip itself into shape at a certain level. You already sort of see some of them taking a little bit of a new attitude towards Trump. And, you know, it's not unlike what I'm hearing from sort of establishment liberal Democrats around here and what Obama is saying. They're trying to soften this over. And they're trying to kind of suggest that this might not really be as awful as it actually is. You know, Trump had to say all these hideous, horrible, awful things in order to get elected. But now once he's in, we'll see a kinder, softer side. And I'm picking up some of that. I don't monitor the media enough. You know, at the same time, they'll probably be a little more hard-hitting in terms of investigations on conflicts of interest and problems inside the Trump White House. I expect they will get more coverage from the New York Times and Washington Post than such things would have ever gotten in the Hillary Clinton administration. So I don't know how they reconstitute themselves. A lot of people are very sort of standoffish now about mainstream media. In part, they feel misled about the outcome. They felt lulled into a very false sense of security because everyone was listening to these polls and they were all over CNN at the time. What did the New York Times had Hillary at 85% likelihood, at least before the Comey revelations, and then it only went down to about 75% likelihood for Hillary Clinton, and people feel burned.
Lots of things have been upended and assumptions proved wrong. It seems, if one believes the vote count, that Trump won a majority of union households.
Well, you know, Dan, I don't find that surprising. And a lot of folks who've had some contact with predominantly white working class people in the heartland will tell you that that's not surprising. One of the most memorable moments in, I think it was the last presidential debate, or, you know, maybe it was the second one, there was this remarkable moment where Trump was preposterous and ridiculous on so many levels. And I think a lot of us on the left knew that, and we'd be listening to him. But then every once in a while, he'd say this thing. It was just, like, absolutely correct, right? It was right. You know, you nailed it, Donald. That's correct. And so I remember one of these debates, Donald did that. He was talking about NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, and he said that it cost millions of Americans their livelihoods and led to a lot of jobs being shut down and moved overseas and so on and so forth. And they had a split screen during it. And while he said it, you could see Hillary's face. Oh, and she rolled her eyes and she made this great big smile. You know, the whole facial expression of, you've got to be kidding, Donald. It was as if he had just rolled out again the line that Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States of America, right? It's as if he said the most preposterous thing. Well, goddamn, I mean, hundreds of thousands, millions of working people from Ohio to Wisconsin to Michigan to Pennsylvania, coast to coast, know that that sentence by Donald Trump was correct. And, you know, that just epitomizes the mentality of the Democratic Party. I'm not surprised they lost union households. I was watching so-called public broadcasting system NewsHour on the night of the election, and Nancy Pelosi, the epitome of an elite bi-coastal Democrat, was actually asked by one of the reporters, are you concerned about the alienation of the working class, the white working class in this country? And she just, you know, flatly, completely dismissed the notion that the Democrats aren't just clearly and obviously the party of all working people. And she said the notion that NAFTA had screwed people over was just a right-wing myth. And I was just thinking to myself, well, you're going to find out tonight, aren't you? And she did.
So what does this say about the historical and current relationship between organized labor and the Democratic Party? Organized labor gives the Democrats tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars every election cycle. And yet, if the numbers are true, they couldn't even deliver the rank and file in terms of votes.
Right, yeah. This should have been dead a long time ago. I mean, 2008, Obama came in. John Edwards started it during the campaign, but Obama picked it up. I heard him embrace again and again. One of the most basic existential policy changes that labor desperately needs, which would have been Employee Free Choice Act. And it disappeared really from Inauguration Day 2009 on. It was never word boo about the Employee Free Choice Act, which would have been basically what's called card check authorization. Without going into the detail, it would have been a re-legalization of union organizing in this country. Without that, labor has no chance of expanding. And Obama campaigned on it and dropped it completely. Obama completely excluded something else that working people have in labor for many years, not the top labor bureaucrats, but laboring people forever have wanted: single-payer national health insurance. I mean, if we made health care provided through government health insurance a human right, it would enhance the workplace bargaining power and the marketplace bargaining power of workers dramatically. If they knew they had that kind of fallback, that they didn't put their own health care coverage and their family's health care coverage at risk for challenging the employer clients, it would enhance capacity, freedom to strike and organize and do the types of things that unions have done historically and which need to do again. And Obama completely excluded single-payer people thoroughly from the health care reform process from day one of his inauguration. Now they played games with a public option and couldn't even commit to anything remotely serious. Okay, so, you know, why should labor, why should working people be lined up with the party of NAFTA, the party of corporate health care, the party of bail out the banks and don't give a bailout for the working people, the party of no public jobs programs? I could go on, you know, the party of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I mean, Barack Obama was trying to, thankfully he now has to give up, to burnish his fake progressive legacy with this arch-corporatist, anti-labor, anti-environment Trans-Pacific Partnership. I mean, what does that say about how far that party has drifted away from the working class?
Yes, if organized labor, shrunken as it is, could break with the Democrats, there would be the material basis for a new social democratic party.
They have to purge their leadership. Richard Trumka at the AFL-CIO has been a close buddy of Bill Clinton's for years and has been cited on more than one occasion hanging out at the penthouse above the Clinton Presidential Library when big dog William Jefferson Clinton is in town in Little Rock. They party together. They hang out together. How about that fellow Stern, who was the head of the SAIU, Andy Stern, who was one of the leading operatives making sure that single payer died as a demand on the part of organized labor in the 2008 campaign? I mean, these people are collecting multi-hundred-thousand-dollar salaries, getting put on NGO boards, and basically living a highlight. It's like a Marxist dystopia, the aristocracy of labor just selling out the working class. These are the people who shut down the social movement in Wisconsin in the spring of 2011 and turned it all into a hopelessly dysfunctional campaign, a doomed campaign to try and get rid of Scott Walker and replace him in a recall campaign. These are the labor leadership in that state that was just completely ready to sell out their workforces on wages and on benefits, and only got temporarily agitated when Walker came to take away collective bargaining rights, which would have meant taking away their automatic dues collection, which would have meant taking away their elite salaries, which kind of did to some extent. So, you know, they can't be trusted, and what that means is we have to resurrect rank and file movements within labor and form unions completely outside of AFL-CIO and outside of so-called Change to Win. They are just sinking and sinking and sinking. So it's no surprise that they would go for a guy who says he's against NAFTA, says he's against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, even though he may not really be. But it's no surprise at all. You know, one of the silver linings of Trump winning is it, I think, is feeding a sense that Dr. Cornel West wrote something in The Guardian about this the other day, that maybe this signals the death knell, you know, the final collapse, the final end of the Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Hamilton Project, Democratic Leadership Council, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, Bob Ruman, Lawrence Summers, neoliberal ideology atop the Democratic Party. I mean, what has it delivered? I mean, on the eve of this election, the media was going on and on and on about the crisis and the implosion of the Republican Party. Look at the Democratic Party with all these neoliberals, these Debbie Wasserman Schultzes and Hillary Clintons atop it. It now has lost the executive branch and thereby will have lost the tipping power for the judicial branch, for the Supreme Court. It continued to be the minority party in the House of Representatives and the Senate, and the Republican Party, which is held in disapproval by two-thirds of the American population. It's a hated institution. The Republican Party has all three branches of the federal government, and it has the great majority of the state governments throughout this country. That is simply astonishing. And that's what these dismal dollar Democrats have, to no small extent, brought upon themselves. Well, brought upon us. They're still going to live high on the hog, let me put it that way.
That was author and activist Paul Street.
Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, are planning a giant rally in Philadelphia next month. Abu-Jamal is battling hepatitis C, but the Pennsylvania prison system refused to treat him for the disease, which also afflicts thousands of other inmates. Pam Africa says Mumia's supporters are fighting to keep him alive.
Health-wise, Mumia's not doing good at all. He has the appearance of good health. And his brother was just up to see him last week, and he's itching all over. And this started a couple months ago, and because he was given a medication that has slowed the itch down, and now he's taking something called Tesla, which is given for a rash. Mumia has hepatitis C. He has an active hepatitis C. And the health of Mumia is declining.
The hepatitis C virus, of course, attacks the liver.
Yes. And there was a recent ruling on Mumia where a judge has stated that the hepatitis C has got to be treated for all inmates, and all because the protocol that was written down for the prison, which is one that we forced them to give us in court, the protocol put forth by the Hepatitis C Treatment Review Committee exposes inmates and the care of the DOC to these risks, despite knowing that the standard of care is to treat patients with chronic hepatitis C with DAA medications such as Harvoni or Sovani, regardless of the stage of disease. The DOC defendant's own expert, Dr. Jay Cohen, acknowledged that the standard of care is to treat every patient for whom treatment with direct-acting antiviral medication is not medically contradicted, regardless of disease progression or status as an incarcerated person. The interim protocol does not do this. Instead, it opts for monitoring of patients who are affected with chronic hepatitis C with active treatment, as indicated above, being delayed until the disease had progressed to the point that scarring of the liver has turned to cirrhosis and liver malfunction. What we're pointing out is that a judge looked at this case and said that it was unconstitutional for them to allow this kind of condition to exist, because in order to get the treatment, and this is where we're at with Mumia, and in order to get the treatment, you have got to have, your liver has got to be in advanced cirrhosis of the liver, which over 60% of the liver has got to be hardened, and or you have got to be bleeding from your veins in your chest, and your esophagus has got to be bleeding in order to get on the list for the cure. So where we're at with Mumia, the liver had started hardening, you know, last year. And this is from the doctor's reports. And right now, he's taking a medication. He's had diarrhea for over 2 months. His itching has returned. He says there's not a place that he hasn't itched, scratched, and, you know, like pulled up into sores because of the intense itching. And instead of them giving him the cure, they're allowing him and other inmates to suffer the way they're, you know, where they're suffering.
In other words, the prison authorities are saying that they can't treat Mumia's hepatitis C until it's damn near killed him.
Right, right. And there was other inmates who had it. One political prisoner, Seth Hayes, up in New York, he down there died with his hepatitis C. But when they administered the cure, it cured the hepatitis C, but all the side effects of the damage by the malfunction of the liver and, you know, the veins bleeding and things caused him other problems. So he's still in danger of not being able to live. This is Seth Hayes, a political prisoner in upstate New York. And we see what's happening with Mumia now and other inmates. So we've been desperately pushing to have them give him the medication. And what we've managed to do is to get city council people, after almost 2 years of battling with them, to actually send a notice and to pass the city council calling upon Governor Wolf and the Pennsylvania state legislature to ensure that individuals incarcerated and working in state prisons have access to clean water and proper health care. Now, the issue with the clean water is another thing that is killing a lot of inmates in the prisons. The prison where Mumia's at, the water is running black and it's oily. And they're actually given, at first they wasn't giving them any water. They had to drink juice. And on Mumia's diabetic from the treatment that he's been taking, you have to drink the juice from the vending machines, and it's high in sugar. When they started giving him water, the water was like 3 cups of water 3 times a day. And that's all in the hottest of weather. And even now, that's what they're getting. But we found out in the state of Pennsylvania, all the waters at the prisons are causing a lot of bad conditions for inmates. In one prison, the inmate's hair is beginning to fall out. I'm talking about young folks coming into the prison are beginning to lose their hair. In Aviance prison, they said the water is black. And our each and every state prison in Pennsylvania is having, you know, problems with the water. And the inmates are actually dying from the water. Mumia with open sores was told that, you know, you either, you know, take a shower or don't. It's up to you. So the conditions is really, really bad. And what we're doing on December the 9th, and this is the day that 35 years ago, they attempted to kill Mumia in the streets of Pennsylvania and failed. And we fought the entire government from presidents on down in order to get Mumia off of death row. And we knew that once Mumia came off of death row, they were going to plan some other kind of way of killing him. It wasn't long that Mumia developed this hepatitis C, which was progressing so fastly on him. He came off of death row, and then all of a sudden he's itching. They rushed him to the hospital because the medication that they gave him almost put him into a diabetic coma. And his body became encased with this black substance all over. And we darn near lost him twice, only to get him to the point where he's just about doing better. Thing turned around and took a turn for the worse again. Now and again, when you hear Mumia do commentaries, he sounds good. But if you listen to the breathing, he's having breathing problems, right now. His mind, he says, at times is really foggy. And this is a result of this new Otezla medication that they're giving him. Instead of giving him the cure, they give him a medication that when you see it on TV, you'd be like, wow, who would take that? He's taking it because he needs some kind of relief. He said he can't think and he want to write and get these commentaries out. So what we're asking people to do for Mumia, what Mumia has done for all of us, and let's stand up and put the word out about what's going on. December the 9th, we are calling for a huge demonstration in Philadelphia that will start at 3 o'clock in front of the Rizzo statue. That's 15th and JFK Boulevard. Followed by a open town hall meeting at 6:30 at the Broad Street Ministries. And we're really asking people to come because Mumia is holding on steadfast and getting information out. And we're working, diligently to try to save his life by exposing the insanity. Anytime you have a Supreme Court justice who says that this is unconstitutional, anytime you have an entire city council write to the governor, pass a resolution saying that what they're doing in these prisons is wrong and they need to step in. And what we're stating very clearly, that this government here, knowing full well what they're doing, it's a constitutional violation and other officials are speaking out, they're in the process of committing cold-blooded, premeditated murder. And they also have what we call an abuse of power. We have an attorney by the name of Michael Cord here who is going to file criminal complaints on behalf of, we the people who are forced to sit and watch a situation where you have a cure and you refuse to give it to people until their esophagus is bleeding, their chest is busted, the veins in their chest is busting, and their liver is over 60%. Cirrhosis of the liver. You're talking about murder. You're talking about a torturesome murder. And this is what we're trying to stop for Mumia in the prison in Pennsylvania, 7,000 other men, women, and children. We're also getting the word out that over 46,000 people in the community in Philadelphia has hepatitis C. Now, you will see the commercials on TV about the cure for hepatitis C, and they're telling people to get it. But what they're not telling people, the cure is $1,000 a pill, and people can't afford that. And in the prison, what they're clearly pointing out is that, they can't afford it. But it is this government who allowed a person to go over to India and to Egypt and get the cure there, buy the cure, come back here to the United States and change one thing in the cure and get with the FDA. And they allowed them to charge $1,000 for a pill, which in Egypt costs $4. No, in India it's $4, in Egypt it's $7. This is criminal in itself. So, we're asking people to rise up with us. We're having a very detailed, thorough investigation into it with facts so that people can take it back into their communities and fight this, because this is not a Pennsylvania problem. This is not a Mumia problem. This is throughout the United States of America problem. And it's a problem around the world because they do have the cure in other countries outside here. So it's not just, and it's an epidemic that they're not talking about that's affecting people. They're just not being truthful about it at all. So the way to stop the murder of Mumia and other people is by getting the information out and talking about what it is that we can do.
That was Pan Africa of Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And here is Mumia himself with a commentary on the election of Donald Trump. He titles it, Tears and a Smile.
For many across America, the presidential election has left them distraught, awash with anxiety, fear, and dread. It seems surreal. A candidate caught on tape saying what he said, who launched a pernicious hate campaign directed at Mexicans and Muslims, a man who seemed to embody a sense of doom. And yet, Donald Trump has snatched the brass ring, the prize of prizes of politics, his first and only political race and victory. By doing so, he has made U.S. political history. For good or ill, this election may transform American politics. It would be accurate to say that economic discontent played a part, the result of the Clinton-era NAFTA pact for the North American Free Trade Agreement. But that's not all. The Trump campaign represented not just fear, but profound paranoia, and also white revenge for the darkening of America. If Trumpism represented vengeance, then Clintonism represented betrayal. For every constituency that voted for Bill Clinton, gays, blacks, you name it, the Clintons supported bills like DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act, the AEDPA, an anti-habeas corpus bill, or NAFTA, despite massive labor support, all built on betraying their interests. But these are indeed dark days in Babylon, the politics of vengeance versus the politics of betrayal. That's quite a choice, isn't it? A smile? Yes. For this too shall pass.
Political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. President-elect Donald Trump appears to have chosen Mike Pompeo, a former Republican congressman from Kansas, as the next director of the CIA. Ray McGovern is a retired former analyst for the CIA who now spends most of his time fighting the ever-growing power of the national security state. McGovern was recently interviewed by Paul Jay of the Real News Network. McGovern says there's a big problem with naming Mike Pompeo as CIA chief.
He's a big fan of torture. In other words, if there were any doubt that Trump was talking reality and not just appealing to the basest instincts of the American people for vengeance, it's now dispelled by the fact that he's picked as his CIA director an aficionado of torture. He visited Guantanamo. He thought it was great. He said, you know, as far as I could see, those prisoners are gaining weight. So that's what we're faced with here, a fellow who's going to turn back the clock. And, you know, if Obama had the strength of his convictions and didn't decide just to look forward and not look backwards, he would have gotten rid of the torturers in the CIA. He let them stay, and now they're having a celebration with the notion that their new director will be a fan of torture.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.